All rise. The court is in session.
Morning, please be seated. Next case is, excuse me. SC 966, Larson and others against Sinclair Transportation Company. Before we begin, let me explain. Justice Martinez will not participate. His resignation is effective on Halloween. And, excuse me, Justice Hobbs will participate. He's out of town today, and he'll listen to the arguments on tape. So with that said, this is a case we've had previously argued. There were two additional cert questions that were certified, 30 minutes, 15 minutes per side, and the appellant has to keep track of their time. And please tell us your name and who you represent when you start your argument. Thank you.
May it please the court, Ben Cohen from Paulsonelli Shugart, representing the landowners, Ivor and Donna Larson, and Dr. Lauren and Kay Sandberg. With me at council table is trial counsel Dan Dean from Dean and Reed in Fort Collins. I'm going to pick up this oral argument where we left off almost a year ago. You may recall Justice Hobbs asked a question about how Colorado was supposed to get its natural resources to market if the companies that develop these resources don't have condemnation authority to lay pipelines. Now, Your Honors, we don't necessarily disagree with the observation that it would be a good idea for companies like Sinclair to have condemnation authority for gasoline pipelines, but that is not a result that you can implement from the bench. In fact, if Justice Hobbs wants that result, he would have to step down from the bench, like his colleague Justice Martinez, run for a seat in the General Assembly, because as you know, only the General Assembly grants condemnation powers. This court's job, by contrast, is to construe those grants narrowly. And when this court does look at the condemnation statute at issue here, 35-5-105, we submit that this court must conclude that the condemnation statute applies to electrical transmission infrastructure. It is not a general purpose condemnation statute. I'm not going to review the statutory construction. We're here for different arguments. But we can't help but emphasize that what the court needs to do in this case is to vacate the condemnation judgment due to Sinclair's lack of condemnation authority and remand for landowners to recover their attorney's fees. Now, as the court, I'm sure, appreciates, it would not be long before Sinclair actually obtains condemnation authority. It may go to the General Assembly in the upcoming legislative session, and that is why this court needs to also take this opportunity to weigh in and provide guidance on the very important safety issues that have been presented and briefed for this argument. Question here is whether evaluation jury should be allowed to take into consideration a developer's decision to implement a reasonable safety setback around a dangerous gasoline pipeline. Now, there's no question that developers are entitled to compensation when a company like Sinclair lays a dangerous gasoline pipeline across property. The old cases, though, base their compensation analysis on a fear factor. The idea is that the developer builds right up as close as possible to the dangerous gasoline pipeline, but people don't want to live in those houses right next to the gasoline pipeline because of the danger, because of the possibility in the event of a leak or a rupture, they could be incinerated. So the developer has to sell those houses at a discount. And there are lots of cases. We cite the ALR that is, in fact, on the website of Fagri and Benson that lists about three dozen cases talking about fear factor as being recognized as compensable. But these landowners did not take that approach in the trial court. They are not going to build right up as close as they can to this high-pressure gasoline pipeline. Rather, what they intend to do is to implement a safety setback. They simply won't put people in harm's way where they could be killed in the event of a pipeline accident. And what they're asking is for the right to present to a valuation jury the evidence. Just explain to the jury, this is how we're going to develop. We're not going to build very close to the pipeline, and we think that Sinclair should be obligated to pay for all of the land that it effectively takes when it runs a high-pressure gasoline pipeline through the middle of the property. Now, in the lower courts, both the trial court and the Court of Appeals, Sinclair managed to keep that entire argument and all of the evidence away from the jury by arguing that it was speculative. And it cited a couple of cases about speculation, but those cases are inapposite. Those are cases holding that it is improper to speculate about a future use of the land in a condemnation case. There's no speculation here. Everybody agreed. The highest and best use of this property is for residential development. The truly opposite cases, you know, we discussed them in our briefs. It's the Russell Cole case, where the Department of Transportation is condemning property for a highway. A coal company owns coal underneath the ground and argues if you take the surface property, you've got to condemn the coal underneath it. Otherwise, the highway will collapse. And the court said, absolutely. The trial courts should have considered these safety issues. Likewise, another important case is the La Plata Electric case, which holds that even when a company condemns some narrow strip of property, if the effect of the condemnation is to limit the use of the remainder of property, that limitation is compensable in a condemnation action. There was an electric line which limited the scenic views of Durango. The landowner got compensation for the property that the landowner couldn't develop because of the high voltage electric lines interfering with the view. And of course, the case this court has most recently decided, Polizzi v. Brighton, certainly applies here because of its holding that evidentiary issues in condemnation cases are expansive. Now, in response to this argument, Sinclair has raised new arguments to try and defend its position. It makes the argument that there's no legal requirement for a developer not to build. They were perfectly allowed to build all the way up to the pipeline, so they shouldn't get compensation for it. That's not correct. The key case on this is the Calvarese case. It's a case where a developer built a residential development over an abandoned mine, and then, sure enough, the home subsided into the abandoned mine, and the developer got sued. And this court followed a long line of cases, which was the Court of Appeals, followed this court's lead in holding that a developer has a common law duty to choose select appropriate land for residential development. The developer has superior knowledge. You simply don't put people in harm's way. If you do, you should expect to get sued. That is why these landowners are not putting houses right next to a dangerous high-pressure gasoline pipeline. Likewise, in the Calvarese case held that the fact that there are no federal or state or county regulations doesn't give the developer a pass. If it's the danger is easily understandable, then the developer has got to take that danger into consideration. And the court in that case also held that there was nothing too esoteric about the dangers of an abandoned mine and subsidence for a lay evaluation jury to deal with, and that is the situation here too. The dangers are straightforward. The pipeline ruptures and leaks, and something ignites it, and there could be an explosion, a fire. If it leaks, we could have people in the houses right next to the easement have gasoline seeping into their basements. That's a very serious danger, and it's well within the ken of a lay jury. Now, Sinclair's final main argument in opposition is that the Larsons are basically just too far ahead of the curve on all of this safety stuff. They argue that if maybe the Larsons, as thought leaders, would not build up close to the pipeline, but we've got to offer evidence that the market as a whole would react that way. Well, Your Honors, that argument would not prevent Ivor Larson from offering testimony in a valuation trial. We've offered a supplemental authority, a recent Court of Appeals case, which holds quite sensibly that even when there is an objective standard, how the claimant or litigant in that case would react is admissible evidence of what a reasonable person would do. So how Ivor Larson chooses to develop this property as the president of the developing company, that is admissible evidence of what the market would do, how it would react to having a high-pressure gasoline pipeline being laid right down the middle. But more importantly, The federal regulatory apparatus is finally catching up. In our last brief...
Can I just ask you a quick question? One of the points in their brief is that you had an opportunity to identify experts to testify to the kinds of things you're talking about, and you didn't disclose any experts.
That's true.
Is that right?
That is true.
So tell me how you see that fitting into your argument.
A couple of ways. We submit that no experts were needed in this case. The issues about the safety setback, all of them are basic and straightforward and are understandable with high school math. The sole exception of how you calculate the appropriate safety setback distance. And for that, we offered or tried to offer into evidence a report from the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Best scientists in the world have done the difficult math and put together a report. We explain in our briefs that that was admissible under Rule 803 sub 8 as a government report. We provide half a dozen cases talking about how similar government reports and NIST reports in particular are appropriately considered in situations like this. Now, if the court vacates Sinclair gets condemnation authority and we end up back, we may well designate a petroleum engineer or similar expert, or we may seek to have Ivar Larson designated as an expert and present this through expert testimony and avoid some of these evidentiary issues. But that would be a matter for a new trial when this case comes back. Briefly, I've only got 5 minutes. I would refer the court to the extensive documentation regarding the PIPA standards, Pipelines and Informed Planning Alliance, the new federal safety standards that have been promulgated since our last oral argument. They specifically hold that pipelines are dangerous, you shouldn't build too close to them, and the smart thing to do is to observe safety setbacks. Exactly what we've been asking for in this case. I'm going to reserve my remaining time for a
moment. Counsel, I'm sorry, before you step away, I'm still having trouble connecting evidence about the danger, the potential danger of these, building a house near a pipeline, and how that impacts the market. And I'm having trouble understanding how Ivar Larson's individual opinion about that as a landowner is somehow representative of how the market, which is many, many, many individuals who might be reacting. And you're linking that using what case?
Calvaracy. I can give you the full site. It's Calvaracy v. National Development Company, 772 P. 2nd, 640. It's in our briefs. It is the case of the developer that built over the abandoned mine. And that is perfectly applicable here, Justice
Martin. And the jury, I'm sorry, clearly I'm not familiar with that case. I will certainly read it. What was the jury determining in Calvarese? Were they determining market value?
No, it was not a condemnation case, but it was a case holding that a developer is under a common law duty to use his superior knowledge of dangers of particular land in order to choose appropriate land for development, and that is exactly what Ivar Larson is doing here.
What was the cause of action then?
The cause of action there was just for negligence, I believe. It was a negligence tort claim against the developer for the people who bought houses that subsided into the abandoned mine.
So the jury was there to determine the negligence of the developer not necessarily the market value.
It was not a condemnation case. It was not about market value. But the developer raised the exact same arguments that Sinclair is raising here. They argued that there was no duty. The court recognized the duty to select appropriate land. They argued that, in the absence of federal or state or county regulations, there's no basis for liability. The court said it didn't matter. The dangers were obvious, and the developer knew about them better than the public at large. Now, Ivar Larson knows about the danger of a high-pressure gasoline pipeline. He's done a lot of research, educated himself, and as a result, if he were to sell this property, he's under a positive duty to tell a new developer, you're going to build on this land, it's dangerous to build next to a high-pressure gasoline pipeline, especially in light of the new PIPA standards, which say, don't do it. Now the market, anybody developing property that's got a high-pressure gasoline pipeline going through it, needs to implement a reasonable safety setback. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Jack Sperber. I'm appearing on behalf of Sinclair Transportation Company. With me at Council's table is my partner, Brandy Caswell. In preparing for today, and now having heard Mr. Cohn's argument, I'm struck once again by how little resemblance there is to the case that was actually tried below. And I've got to express a little bit of frustration about the continuous revolving door of arguments that we've received from the landowners throughout these proceedings, and even in front of this court, with them taking one position in opening briefs and a contrary or different position in their reply brief. To the extent I can find any common themes or common denominators in their arguments, I think they come down to these. First is that the landowners want to litigate issues that simply aren't properly litigated in a condemnation case. And no matter how badly they want it to be, this is not an ordinary civil action where the parties are entitled to present evidence and raise arguments about a wide variety of issues that are in dispute. It's a condemnation case. It's a special statutory proceeding. It's a proceeding of limited jurisdiction. And as Justice Marquez has alluded to, at this phase, the valuation phase of the trial, it's just to determine the market value of the property taken and the diminution in the market value, if any, in the remaining property.
So let me stop you there since our time is short. But maybe boiling down your opponent's argument to just simple terms, shouldn't a landowner be able to testify as to his land in terms of valuation?
I think generally a landowner, and we have case law that allows landowners to express opinions of value, but that is not an authority that allows for kind of carte blanche for them to testify about anything. And I think there are two problems with the landowner's testimony here. The first, as I believe Justice Bender alluded to, is much of the testimony was not really a landowner's opinion of value at all. It was an expert opinion based upon engineering judgments, mathematical analysis, reliance upon hearsay materials from the internet and conversations with other people to develop a theory about the explosive characteristics of these pipelines and the impact that that might create for safety. It was truly an expert opinion, and it was not disclosed, and there is no landowner exception for those kinds of opinions. And so a good body of this evidence was stricken for the failure to disclose that.
But what could a landowner in this situation testify to?
Generally, landowners can testify about their opinions about what the value of their property is worth. But again, there are some limitations upon that. It has to be based upon proper factors. And there's a body of case law. Hyutin is one of the cases that we cited, but there's a whole series of those cases that say owners' opinions still have to be based upon proper factors. And they allow trial courts to make voir dire determinations about the underlying basis for those opinions. And if they're not based upon proper evidence, then they're not allowed to testify to that. In Hyutin, the issue was that they were using listings and unconsummated sales to prove value and a replacement property that they conceded was not comparable. And so the court said those aren't the proper things for an owner to testify to.
So is there, I guess your position is that there was nothing offered in the testimony that was appropriate. There was no appropriate kind of this is what a landowner can testify to.
Well, that's not entirely my position. We actually did this voir dire examination before the jury was set to hear the testimony, specifically based on the Hyutin analysis that says it's better to find out what the foundation of the opinion is first. At the end of that, we moved to strike some of the testimony because not only was it improper, it was also Mr. Larson testified that I'm going to say the exact same things that were already ruled were inadmissible under the motions in limine because I disagree with the trial court's rulings. So he was really kind of snubbing his nose at the prior court's rulings, and the substitute judge who sat in the trial said, you really kind of blew out your own candle here. And that's part of what happened. We then moved to strike opinions about the value of the easement itself that was being taken, and the value about the damages to the remainder of this $4 million damage claim. We didn't move to strike Mr. Larson's opinions that the value of the entire property was $12 million, even though they'd offered it for sale for $3.6 million just 2 years before this date of value. We did have a couple of comparable sales, or allegedly comparable sales, stricken. One that was a sale to a condemning agency that this court has recognized is not appropriate to use as a comparable sale. Another one that wasn't a sale at all, but simply an offer price that was made. And then a final one that they couldn't meet any of the basic elements of comparability. We then moved for a partial directed verdict Mr. Dean, as trial counsel, then got up and moved for a full directed verdict against himself. He said they had no evidence to present and didn't want to present that. So there were opportunities, ample opportunities throughout this for the landowners to present relevant lay opinions about value. They simply chose not to do those things.
You did feel, however, that lay opinion was not proper with regard to anything concerning the safety or location of the pipeline?
Well, I think there were a couple of issues going on there, Justice Coates. One was that the opinions that I alluded to with respect to the hazardous nature of the pipelines and this creating this so-called 1,500-foot setback truly were expert opinions. And they keep saying it's simple math. I invite you to look at the dialogue, the testimony from the deposition, look at their own briefs when they try to explain to you how you get from the NIST report, which incidentally was not ever offered at the trial court level, but how you get from that NIST report to these areas of supposed setbacks. That's just plain and simple expert testimony, and it wasn't disclosed as required by the rules. The other issue is, can a landowner generally testify about concerns about safety and other things? And the body of law there suggests that, yes, they may, if you can make the link to market value that you've asked about. And this ALR that they've alluded to that lays out situations in which owners have been allowed to testify about fears of explosion and safety concerns, all of those cases, whether you follow any of the three different theories for admissibility that we described in the brief, all of them depend upon first establishing that there is an effect on market value, because that is the one and only issue to be decided in a condemnation case. They didn't make that connection. The only thing they offered was Mr. Larson's opinion that this was unsafe. And those cases specifically say that an owner can't just offer that up. Their own fear, their own concerns about safety are not enough because of exactly what you suggested. That is not the market. One individual person does not a market make. It's like the stock market. I might think that a certain stock is overvalued, but unless and until most of the market agrees with me, the needle on that price isn't going to move. And the needle on this price isn't going to move unless there's a market that shares that.
I don't mean to shortcut your argument on this, but your time is very short, and nobody has really talked yet about something that seems to me to be very strange about the way these proceedings worked, and I wondered if you could leap and talk about that. Obviously, it flows from the fact that you were successful in keeping some of their offered evidence out, but it obviously then had the effect, which does seem strange, that then we got into this directed verdict situation, and a jury was never entitled to make an assessment. And that seems to be mixed up with, if you could talk about this at all, with this the case law that we seem to pretty clearly have, although it may be kind of ancient and the explanation for it a little vague, that the landowner has the burden of proving the value. Could you comment on the correctness of the result in this case?
Sure, I'd be happy to. First, I think it is worth pointing out that the landowners are no longer contesting the entry of that directed verdict. They really concede that it was appropriate, and I think they have to because, again, they asked for it. I asked for a partial directed verdict. They got up and asked for a full directed verdict. We had a long dialogue about what that might mean. The trial court asked us multiple times, did we want to send the jury home? I actually offered to go forward with the trial based upon some of the concerns that were raised about how we were going to determine compensation. They insisted that that wasn't appropriate and the jury should go home. And in fact, they now concede that a directed verdict may be appropriate where the only evidence supports the condemnor's valuation position. And I think that it is entirely appropriate in these circumstances, and I'll give you, I guess, a couple of guidelines with that. First, our statutes do contemplate that judges can determine what just compensation is. If the parties stipulate to a judge determining just compensation, and specifically 38.1.101.2a.
The parties didn't stipulate here, right?
Well, I think they effectively stipulated. They stipulated to the jury going home.
And you stipulated to the damage, right?
I'm sorry, what did
you say? You stipulated to whatever damage the trial court entered, right?
I'm not sure I'm understanding.
Well, I didn't understand there's any stipulation here. I'm a little confused.
There wasn't a stipulation that the judge should decide these issues. There was a stipulation, or at least an acknowledgement, that the jury should be sent home. The debate that then took place after that is frankly what I think is unusual about this, which is how is the trial court to then determine what just compensation should be?
Well, definition would be zero. Evidence, yeah. Right?
In a standard case, that would be right. In a case where a directed verdict was entered against a plaintiff, they would receive no damages. Here, Sinclair recognized that they did have an obligation to pay just compensation. And so we offered, under three different theories, what that just compensation should be. And the first was simply that there ought to be a way to interpret our burden of proof for an owner. And this is, frankly, novel. We haven't seen this law anywhere else. And part of that is because there's different burdens of proof throughout the country. But in Colorado, as you've alluded to, it's very clear that the landowner has the burden of proof with respect to determining the market value of the property and damages to the remainder. We argue that because it's always presumed that a condemnor is willing to pay their own estimates of just compensation, that burden of proof should be interpreted as a burden to establish that you're entitled to more than what the condemnor had offered. And so that was the first argument. The second was that the trial court, in granting immediate possession, determined an appropriate deposit. Now, that's not a final determination of compensation, but is a preliminary estimate of what the likely just compensation should be. And so we suggested that. And finally, we made an offer of proof as to what our evidence would have been at the trial. Each of those, frankly, come out to the same number because they were all based upon the same appraisal. But I suppose it's possible that the trial court could have decided that a directed verdict was appropriate and the answer was zero. That's certainly what the landowner advocated for. But that's, in my mind, a separate question than the propriety of a directed verdict at all. It's really a question of what does the court do in determining compensation. And again, we felt that fairness required us to at least pay what our appraisal said the property was worth.
So let me just rephrase that. So you actually believe the burden's on the landowner. If the landowner does nothing, what actually should have happened was the landowner would get zero. But I heard the word fairness concerns, you thought that was a bad result. Is that kind of...
Yeah.
What kind of rule does that lead to, though, in terms of how do we describe that in legal terms?
Well, I think what I'm suggesting is that there are sort of two concepts here. One is whether the landowner met their burden of proof, and if not, whether a directed verdict was appropriate. And I think that's absolutely clear here, and they concede that. The second question is, what do you do beyond that? Do you get $0 or do you get something more? We've argued that whether you call it fairness or whether you call it a constitutional requirement that you pay just compensation, that there ought to be a determination of money owed. And that, again, the presumption is that a condemnor is always going to pay what they have said just compensation should be. And so that if a landowner fails to present any evidence to combat that, the answer ought to be the condemnor's valuation position.
Do you think that it's fair to presume that land is worth something, and so if it's going to be taken, there is some evidence that it's got value, and therefore if a jury trial was chosen by the owner, that he's entitled to have the jury decide how much it's worth? You seem to be taking the position that if he doesn't present any evidence, then there's nothing for the jury to determine.
Well, if I understand your question, I think that's right. And I don't think there's just some unfettered constitutional right to have a jury determine what the property is worth. And that's what I was alluding to when I talked about the statute that allows a judge to make that determination. The Court of Appeals cited a number of cases that talk about...
The statute, though, allows the landowner to choose a jury if he wants to make that determination. Is that not right?
That is true. And what I'm suggesting is that this landowner waived that right when they consented to the jury going home and they asked for a directed verdict against themselves.
You say ask for a directed verdict. I thought it sort of came out, am I wrong on this, that they were saying, if you're going to exclude all our evidence, we don't have anything to present, so we can't make an argument against a directed verdict.
Well, I think it went a little bit further than that. I mean, certainly they were affected by the rulings, but those rulings were a result of calculated judgments by them about not going forward with presenting evidence. You know, they were given multiple bites at the apple to present admissible evidence. They were told beginning at the immediate possession hearing. I see that I'm out of time.
Can I answer Justice Coates' question? That's fine.
They were given multiple bites at the apple. They were told at the immediate possession hearing what the standards were for admissibility. They were told their motions in limine. They never asked for any continuances. They never asked for any opportunity to extend the deadlines for expert disclosures. They simply went forward trying to present the same evidence that they were told that they couldn't. And when those strategic decisions didn't pan out, they really then did ask for a full directed verdict against themselves. I agree that it was a consequence of the evidentiary rulings, but they asked for it. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Cullen, I'll give you a little extra time. I apologize for calling you Mr. Sugar. I elevated you there.
Thank you, Your Honor.
But we'll give you a little time. I'm sorry.
No problem. Briefly, the court has focused on some of the unusual aspects of the trial, such as Sinclair's motions in limine that eliminated landowners' ability to present and even talk at all about safety evidence, and the trial court explained it didn't want to hear anything about safety, was beyond the trial judge's pay grade, leave that for the federal regulator who couldn't talk about safety. All of the comparables were eliminated one by one, either by limine motions or through the voir dire process, until landowners had nothing left. So under those circumstances, as Justice Coates observed, the trial counsel did make what sounds like an unusual strategic decision to request a full directed verdict because we've got nothing to present.
Well, what was the appeal with respect to damages then?
If
he requested, other than the exclusion of evidence, what was the appeal with respect to the number, the dollars of damages? How do we even get there?
Well,
did you stipulate to the judge making a determination of whatever it was, $27,000 or something like that?
It was $27,000. First and foremost, Your Honor, this court does not need to address all of these unusual situations because of the fact that the lack of condemnation authority means that this entire...
Well, that's certainly true.
Okay, so if the court...
That isn't what we're talking about right now. Yeah. We're talking about the damage and the valuation and so forth, right?
Right.
So if we agree with you on that, you're right. But that's not what's...
Okay, just wanted to make sure the court understood that if it correctly rules that there's no condemnation authority, then everything is wiped out and we'll do this all over again, and probably quite differently. But we submit that we did have good evidence. The NIST report is a government report. It was admissible. And the PIPA guidelines...
Can I just ask you a question? Maybe I misheard Mr. Sperber. I thought he said you didn't offer... Then this, I can't pronounce it, whatever the N letters are, report.
The
is that
NIST,
wrong?
National Institute of Standards
That's okay.
and Technology.
Is that report, incorrect?
I believe it was incorrect, Your Honor. At least a part of that report, the key part that has the graph that the landowner used to determine safety setback, was offered below as part of a request for judicial notice. So it was all there. And briefly, the question of what to do under these enormous circumstances, let me just say one last thing about it. It was an unusual strategic decision by trial counsel, but it got us here, and it got this court reviewing the case. So we would ask the court to reverse the condemnation judgment due to the lack of condemnation of authority, remand for an award of fees, and provide guidance for when this case does come back, when Sinclair does obtain condemnation authority, provide guidance regarding a landowner's common law appropriate right to present these safety issues to evaluation jury.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank both attorneys for their arguments. The case will be submitted on the briefs.